Welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is probably one of the best connected people on the planet. So much so that she's been made the world's first professor of networking. She's also an entrepreneur, a business consultant. She was made an OBE for her services to business. And of course, she features here because she's a highly respected author. Julia Hobsbawm, thanks for agreeing to come on Meet the Writers.
Oh, thank you. It's a total pleasure.
So your new book, Fully Connected, it's all about surviving and thriving in an age of overload. It takes us on a journey, and as you say in the beginning, from telex to Twitter. So I'd like to start by going back to, what was it, Bloomsbury in 1964. So you come from such an interesting family. Your father, Eric Hobsbawm, he was a prominent Marxist, a great historian. He was born in Alexandria.
Yes, I have an illustrious family history. Lots of people know me through my father. My family came from Middle Europe, even though my dad was technically born in Alexandria. And I got into a lot of trouble once giving an interview where I described my family as refugees. And they objected to this because they regarded themselves on my mother's side as émigrés. My father actually was in Berlin in 1933 as a teenager, passing the billboard that said that Hitler had come to power. And he ended up in London and ultimately went to the very British and local, to where we're recording, Marylebone Grammar School, and then served even in the British Army. But my mother's side were fleeing, albeit with, as my uncle put it, our walnut table from Innsbruck.
Yes, and probably smart.
Yes, but it is an interesting identity point how people who move across the globe, some wish to repudiate the idea that they are fleeing and that if they're slightly choosing the manner in which they do so, that that makes them less refugee than others. And I often wonder about how that fundamental rootlessness and that sense of diaspora, because I'm also a secular Jew, has influenced my view of the world and of people. Mm. I think probably it makes me, I hope it makes me quite broad-minded and diverse in my outlook, which is a big thing I think we need in order to survive this age that we're in, is to sort of not jam ourselves into any form of silo mentality, any form of groupthink.
Mm. And do you think that that sense of displacement, perhaps albeit inherited, is what drives you to connect across so many different fora?
It is interesting. Somebody asked me this recently. I mean, I think I'm a natural communicator. If you had to put me on a behavioural spectrum, you'd say I was an extrovert. I like language. I like the spoken word, the oral word, the written word. But I also think that there's a very funny culture, especially in the working world, of hierarchy, where people are almost taught to believe that there's a sort of caste system of seniority, and that if you've got the right job title or you work for the right company, that makes you a better or more interesting person. And because my own career path has in fact been very unorthodox, I don't have an academic degree. I've worked my way up literally from secretarial roles to being an entrepreneur now, is I feel lucky that I've never had that inherited sense of boundaries, really. And the truth is that it's a wonderful thing to connect with a range of people because people are just so interesting.
Mm-hmm. Let me take you back then to that community, because it was a very strong intellectual community, wasn't it? Based in North London, of Jews who had come from Middle Europe and who then later on really took such a leading part in British society then and now. And it's from that that you sprang. And as you say, didn't do an academic degree, but have gone on, like so many people within that community, to be very successful.
Well, I mean, I think it's fair to say that I was part of a powerful network. I mean, North London, for those of your listeners around the world, you know, North London, if it's uttered in certain circles in the media, is synonymous with a certain kind of metropolitan liberal elite. And I experienced that in two contexts. One is that I went to a school called the Camden School for Girls, which many, many writers and creative thinkers sent their daughters to. Probably the most famous alumni of that school is actually the actress Emma Thompson. So that was, in a way, one network. And schools are, I believe, often used by parents as a proxy for their own networks. But that's a whole other conversation. The other network and environment that I suppose I flourished in was an intellectual one that my parents fostered. My father was a Euro-communist, a Marxist, as you say. And so a lot of key figures from around the world, from India, from Italy, came to our house, writers, thinkers, academics. So I had an amazing view as a child of those kinds of people and those kind of minds. But funnily enough, I myself felt and arguably was quite a failure. I don't know, even now, aged 53, whether that was part of my own psychology, the family system, if you like. But I was completely unconfident until way, way past my 30s, arguably my 40s, and I didn't do well at school. I wonder whether being the generation of people who had to leave and be rootless and suffer persecution doesn't in some way form a deep subterranean anxiety and lack of confidence, which I didn't really have a name for until I was much older. Mm. And in fact, slightly bizarrely, I was not part of the Jewish North London network. It's only now in my 50s that I'm actually a bit involved in the community and exploring what it means to be Jewish. But in fact, politically, in the 1970s and 80s, if you came from a certain place, you couldn't really belong to the Jewish community. And I didn't even really find out I was Jewish until I was about 14, which sounds crazy, but is the case. That there was a very famous television series called The Holocaust, which was pretty gripping drama. And my parents said, apropos the fact that their friend had paintings featured in the drama, oh yes, and of course that, you know, that's very much our story. And I said, what do you mean? Because of course, to come from that emigre/refugee heritage, you either embraced fully your Jewishness or you sort of quote-unquote assimilated and effectively covered it up. And It wasn't until my dad died in 2012 that he asked for as a condition of the service that Kaddish, the Jewish prayer, be said. And that was pretty much the first time in his life, i.e. not in his life, in his death, when ultimately he wanted that marker. Mm. So I think it's quite an interesting environment in which to grow up, where you wholly are of a people that have experienced suffering, but it's not talked about.
Mm, absolutely. So talking about then the sense of failure, nobody looking at you, reading your incredibly impressive CV, experiencing any of the events that you organise or the talks that you give, would have any idea about that. What do you think then for you was a defining moment that really set you on the path to this tremendous success that you enjoy now?
Well, thank you. That's a very nice compliment. I mean, I think that most of us feel pretty small inside. I think the huge success globally of Susan Cain's book, Quiet, about the power of the introvert, spoke to the fact that we are increasingly a loud world that celebrates noise and self-promotion and broad shoulders and sharp elbows. But what I came to understand is that even though I'm instinctively open and friendly and probably a bit of a risk taker, the truth is inside I often feel, like we all do, come on, insecure or uncertain. And actually, in a way, I've been lucky because I did fail at school academically. I was sort of written off at this famous Camden School for Girls. Lots and lots and lots of people went through to Oxbridge, and I was pretty much taken to one side and told, don't bother, love, you won't make it. And actually, I wasn't very bothered, but they were bothered. And what that meant was that I was given a freedom to decide what I really was interested in without any pressure, actually, because nobody noticed. There's a wonderful phrase, I think, in Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, this extraordinary dystopian novel written in 1985, which I think is just being made into a TV series again now. But it's about invisibility. And it says, we were the people on the blank white pages at the edge of the print. It gave us more freedom. And that phrase has always stuck in my mind. So even though I think it's fair to say that some of what I've been talking about 15 years about connectedness and networks and what real networking is has been either ignored or worse, ridiculed, is actually given me the space and the freedom to explore it. And that has given me the confidence, do you see?
Absolutely.
That has given me the ability to say, do you know what? I believe in this. And that's a wonderful feeling.
Mm. Well, let's look at how practically you've used that in your business life, because you founded the successful knowledge networking business. It's Editorial Intelligence. And that website collates all the newspaper columns of the day, which is fantastic. There's an awards ceremony. There's also your festival come conference, Names Not Numbers. So tell me about that side of your business.
So I was in actual communications for a number of years in book publishing, and I set up my own PR company in the 1980s, and we did very well. But I was very aware that there was a pivot moment in this era where I'd begun on the telex. And, you know, for those of you listening who have no idea what a telex is, and I'm sure that's most of you, it's basically like a really ugly, lumbering old typewriter that used to send electronic messages. And during the course of my career in communications, when the media was more or less a funnel in which information was sort of dropped, one began to see the explosion of channels, 24/7 television, and of course the arrival of the internet. 25 years we've had what the social scientist Rainey and Wellman call the triple revolution of the internet, social media, and now the mobile. It is a revolutionary, extraordinarily rapid moment of change. And so I began to be interested actually in information flows and how they were transacted. And so whilst I had a career in publicity, I became less and less interested in that and much more interested in the relationships between different groups of people and how in a data world that was becoming very difficult. So in 2005, I took a risk, set up a business called Editorial Intelligence, and I thought we were going to be a data business actually for the first 2 or 3 years. And so I made a bet, which has actually paid off, that of the media, as it was expanding so rapidly, the trusted commentators, the authorial voice of people who write the unbylined leaders in the opinion pages and the very bylined columnists were going to play a central role culturally. At the time, I thought, you know, one makes millions of mistakes in business, and this was one of my many. I thought that if I ran a data business collating biographies of every single columnist in the UK in a sort of drawdown subscription database with a summary of the topics they wrote on, that would be a good business model. It was a complete and utter disaster. But by the time I realised it was a disaster, we'd spent an awful lot of money reading and summarising a million words of print a month. And then I decided to sort of use the offcuts of this disaster. And 10 years ago, we created something called The Digest, which you refer to, which is a free service that produces a daily push rather than pull model email out to an audience, which just summarizes with deliberately no links the headlines on what is being said by every single commentator in every single British page newspaper. That proved very successful. And out of that community, we created the awards ceremony. But it also led me to believe that the content programming side of what I could do with networks and networking could also be brought into the business, i.e. to turn it into a people business that had digital product.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what Editorial Intelligence is. It's a content and a connection business. But I suppose what is interesting about it and counterintuitive and counter commercial, arguably, is that we really deliberately do things on a very small scale. I'm almost allergic to anything that has more than 150 people in it at any given time. That's actually the anthropological, more or less maximum number of people that can comfortably coexist. It's so-called the Dunbar number. So we do everything on a very small scale, anything from 15 to 150 people. And at the heart of it is clever, curated content. And that led me through thousands and thousands of people downloading our material or attending over time our events to feel ready to tackle this big subject about modern connectedness. But it's a rather nice moment when suddenly people actually are interested in what you've been banging on about for years. I just read the wonderful autobiography by Chrissy Hynde of The Pretenders. I'm so unlike her in every single way. She was a sort of really quite a risky bad girl, and I'm a bit of a goody two shoes underneath. But the fact is, she writes very movingly and clearly about the many, many, many years in which all she wanted to do was write and perform music, and absolutely nobody was interested. And then in that funny, mysterious, magical way, it just burst into life and everybody suddenly was interested.
Well, people are so interested in what you do that, in fact, as we said at the beginning, a whole new post was created for you, a professor of networking. Tell me about that.
So the Cass Business School, the City of London University, we had a collaboration with them through Editorial Intelligence and the Names Not Numbers conference. And I was just talking to the dean and I said that my belief was, and I think this is actually proving the case, that business education needed badly to update itself, that the business leaders of tomorrow were not necessarily understanding a more lateral networked world. And so on that basis, they asked me, it's an entirely honorary position. I have one at the City University of London and one at the University of Suffolk in East Anglia in Britain. It's really so far just about putting a marker down and saying that networks and networking are very, very misunderstood and they're often not treated or seen together. So, for instance, networking is almost seen as a sort of a skill like driving, that somehow you tick it off on the books. And the way it's currently taught still globally, which I still believe needs to change, is as part of a crammed induction programme. Networking, all the evidence shows, is absolutely nothing to do with working the room, nothing to do with short-term results, everything to do with having something to say and having a small group of relationships that build out and aggregate over time. And at the same time, the whole question of networks is almost treated entirely separately. So one of the things I've become interested in my teaching and in my writing is bringing some of the truly exciting, rich, complex history of networks, the science of networks, into play when we think about how humans behave. And it's a field I'm calling behavioural networks, in the same way that we do now have behavioural economics. So I open the book with the network story of the spread of Ebola in East Africa in 2014. It's a story of human networks. It's a story of the physical and emotional and cultural ties that spread and bind people. It's the story, fascinating story, I think, of the epidemiological spread, how disease spreads and how pandemics spread in particular. The only structure in networks that is identical epidemiologically in society of what's called a scale-free network, a very particular kind of network that just mushrooms out, is of course the internet. And the other story of networks and connectedness that I tell through the illustration of this ghastly outbreak in West Africa is of political connectedness and disconnection. And the headline on that is that, with the exception of Liberia, led by the only African woman leader, which imposed a very brave, controversial quarantine, which ultimately brought the illness's spread to a halt. In fact, all the African nations that were affected were spreading it because politically they felt they couldn't admit they had it. And so they went into denial. Now, for me, connectedness is so interesting politically, culturally, technologically, epidemiologically, and I felt the Ebola story illustrated that.
Absolutely. As you say, that's told at the beginning of the book, Fully Connected, which is basically split into two parts. The Way to Wellville is the first part, and that's all about really what we're up against. What is the blueprint for social health?
So I was interested in the concept of why I don't think the connected world, for all of its marvellousness, is healthy. So put simply, global productivity is stagnant. It's not thriving. Stress levels globally are high. 10 million working days alone in the UK are lost to stress. And I feel that for all the advances of technology, the human being is proving resistant because the neuroscience and the physiology and the cultural history of the human really does show quite clearly that we're out of kilter with the speed and scale of the technology era. And so I thought, if I took as a starting assumption things are not well, things are not healthy, things are not functional, and began to look at actual health, it brought me to two very interesting observations. One is that the World Health Organization's definition of health was created 70 years ago after the Second World War, and that arguably we're now a reasonably similar pivot moment of massive change. And that largely, with the exception, if you like, possibly, of obesity, which is a rather perfect storm of the television, the sugar industry and the car, global health is obviously very much improved since then. And the global fitness and wellness industry is massive. It's actually $3.5 trillion. It's double the published total of the arms trade. So it's huge. So in some senses, we have become successful at looking after our health in 70 years. But the original definition of health, which hasn't been changed, actually going to call on the incoming Director General of the WHO to change the definition when they come in July, is that health is, and I quote, not merely the absence of injury and disease, but the presence of physical, mental and social well-being. Now, that's really interesting to me, because social in 1946 couldn't possibly have meant what social means now. And so my point is this. Given that we know we have and can improve literacy, behaviours, strategies and tactics around physical, mental health, wellness, pretty much all your listeners, I would imagine, do know the difference between a carb or a calorie, have bought a vitamin, have got some sort of fitness apparel. You could argue that that's a very good blueprint for social health, which is let's now start to own the literacy and the behaviours around the core ingredients that go with connectedness. And those are, I believe, very simple. There's only three of them. One is how we manage our knowledge and our information, our infobesity. The second is how we manage our networks. And I don't just mean the difference between being on or offline, but I mean simply the chaos that there are so many data systems that we're grappling with, and that we forget that databases are supposed to be people bases. They're supposed to be a marker of your connectedness to other humans. And the third is that the one thing we have absolutely little of in relation to this excess everywhere else is time. Every single person on the planet is united by the same amount of time. It hasn't changed since the Sumerian calendar. It's 168 very small hours in the week, which if you compare that to the billion people on Facebook in a single day last year, after which Mark Zuckerberg said, and I quote, it's just the beginning of connecting the whole world. If you think that the average active user on Facebook spends 50 minutes a day on Facebook, you've got a dissonance, you've got a disconnect going on, which really I'm trying to address in the book.
The second half is about the blended self, where the kind of overlap between the personal and the professional. And the book also then goes on to give us six practical steps.
Yes, I mean, I almost didn't want to give practical steps because this is probably more sociology and philosophy and theory, hopefully presented in an accessible way. But the market, they want to know practical things. And so I do end with six concrete ideas. And I suppose the one to highlight is this. If you buy my argument that the way we look at our physical and our mental health, our fitness, if you like, is transferable to the way we look at our connectedness. That what we put in our bodies is a key part of how we manage, for example, our nutrition. The 5-a-day campaign is one of the most successful global marketing campaigns ever. And that is exactly what it is. It's a marketing campaign. I mean, it's not empirical.
Yeah, probably incorrect.
It's probably incorrect. But I mean, it works in the sense that it focuses people's minds on the fruit and vegetable intake. If that's the case, then probably the single piece of advice I would give you out of these six is treat your diary like your body. That spend your time as judiciously as you treat your body. In our society, if anybody else puts anything in your body without your consent or your permission, it usually means that you're either incapacitated or you're a victim of some kind. Mm. We need to own the way we spend our time. Most of the working world and the working culture totally disregards this.
Julia Hobsbawm, thank you for choosing to spend your time with me on Meet the Writers.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Julia Hobsbawm's book, Fully Connected, Surviving and Thriving in an Age of Overload, is published by Bloomsbury. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Claire Urban and Maria Granina. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.